Welcome to Judaism Demystified, a podcast for the perplexed. We are joined by Frank Mink. Frank Mink is probably one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my life and truly an inspiration. I don't want to give away too much in the intro. You're going to find out everything you need to know about his life, but it's really the ultimate redemption story and it's so inspiring. You're really going to enjoy it. He is a former neo-Nazi gang member who spent time in prison and basically discovered his Jewish roots. I'm not going to give it away right now, but many believe his story influenced Edward Norton's character in American History X, and I really think you guys will appreciate this episode. It's a little different than what we usually do, but sometimes you just need a good story. Without further ado, Frank Mink. Thank you for joining the Judaism Demystified podcast. We are honored to have Frank Mink, who is a ex-skinhead, and his story is unbelievable. So before we get into it, I wanted to thank you. You've personally inspired me a lot. I've watched your story on a few channels, and I'm like, I gotta have this guy on. So if you can just tell the audience just how everything started with you, your whole beginning of your journey.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on and thank you for asking me. I'm honored. I'm always honored to get a chance to talk and share my story and share what I'm up to today. So because I obviously have a purpose and I'm doing things for a purpose. So to start off with my story is I wasn't raised Jewish at all. In fact, didn't even know I was Jewish. Was raised in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, was raised believing I was just Irish and Italian, which was for South Philly. That's kind of the perfect mix in where I grew up. My mom and my mom rebelled from her Irish Catholic family and later went and got with an Italian guy who was like a Rocky Balboa. This is the 70s. So, you know, Rocky Balboa. My dad was kind of like a Rocky Balboa superstar guy of the neighborhood, tough fighter, all that good stuff, you know, sell drugs. And my mom liked the bad boy, and that's how I came to be. Those two didn't last very long, not at all. In fact, you know, my mom probably moved out from his house and were they his neighborhood probably when I was about two-ish, maybe three. And we moved in with my grandparents back in the Irish Catholic neighborhood. And anyway, me and my mom wound up moving in on our own, and my mom struggled at times. I remember being on food stamps as a child. I remember having food stamps, like literally being on welfare and having food stamps and being knowing that that was like for the poor people, like as a kid. I mean, that's my thought, you know, it's for the poor people. And, I was embarrassed. You know, I wasn't ashamed of my mom, but I was just kind of embarrassed of our situation sometimes. And I knew that she was doing the best she could. Like even back then, I knew she was doing the best she could. And so we struggled. And so my mom wound up getting remarried to a man who was not a good man to me. You know, he did not like that I was Italian. He didn't like anything about me. I mean, he moved in my mom's house. He's now taking over the house. And here's this little scrappy young guy. I was maybe 9 going on 10 when he moved in my home. And just not a nice man to me. And I basically lived in a house with a bully who liked to bully me around and punish me and beat me and just wasn't good. That's all I could say. I don't want to, you know, can't really give his side of the story, but I was a child and I hated going home every day. I hated going home so badly that I wish sometimes I would get hit by a car like that. When I would come home from school, I only had 2 blocks from my school to my house. You know, it's in South Philly, little neighborhoods and stuff. But my school was only 2 blocks away, man. And I wish some days it was 2 miles away. Because I just hate having to walk straight home to school. I mean, from a school right home. And I would try to get hit by cars because I was like, if I didn't want to die, you know, I was a kid. I didn't want to die. I just wanted to get hit by a car so I can go to a hospital for the day instead of going home. Like, I thought that would be nicer and I'd be kinder. And everyone in South Philly gets hit by cars. Like, it's just the thing to do. You live in them little, small, narrow streets. Everyone's zooming around. Everyone's related. So you're always getting run over by a family member or a cousin. Can't sue anybody. You know what I mean? You just get hit by a car and you shut your mouth. And I'm the one kid that wants to get hit by a car. And it just doesn't happen. And anyway, eventually got in trouble at school. I was 13. And I walked home from school, and my stepdad was waiting for me and beat the living crap out of me. And while he was beating the crap out of me, he told me to pack my stuff. I was going to move with my dad. And my dad lived in a rough neighborhood, even way more rougher neighborhood than my mom's. But it was rough. And I just remember I was happy. Like, I was happy I was at least not going to have to go home to him anymore. I knew I was going to go to a rougher neighborhood, and I knew things were not going to be easy. But I was like, as long as I ain't got to see that man anymore, I'm cool. And so, but I was sad. You know what I mean? My mom gave me up, man. She gave me up for this guy. Like, she wanted this relationship with him. This worked so bad. She was willing to throw me away. And that's what I knew.
Was he
So
also
anyway, that, go ahead.
abusing your mom or just you?
No. My mom's a tough cookie, man. My mom was a drinker and a brawler. She would hit him sometimes. Not about me, just about, whatever. My mom, he didn't abuse my mom. My mom was a tough little cookie, so he mind his P's and Q's with her. In a way, I mean, they were both into drinking and drugs really bad, but I never seen him hit my mom ever, and I actually seen my mom hit him a few times when she was lit up pretty good. So, he just liked taking it out on me, and it's just the way it was. So anyway, that's that year in the middle of the school year, I had to go move to my dad's neighborhood. My dad lives up in Southwest West Philly. Some of you guys, if you ever seen the show Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, where Will Smith sings about West Philly, born and raised on a playground where I spent most of my days, that's my dad's neighborhood. So my white butt moved into that neighborhood that he moved out of. And so I had to go to an all-black school. My dad had a little bar, like a little tavern, that he basically lived at all the time. I never seen the guy, and I just went to the school in this black neighborhood in the black school. And as a new white kid in the middle of the school year, I was kind of a little skateboarder, punk rocker, athlete. I'm a, a born and bred athlete, and I always played sports. Even though I was like a little punk rock kid, always exceeded in sports, always set records, whatever. Not talking ego stuff, just the truth. I was a really, really good athlete. It's in my dad's family's blood. They're all star athletes, and it was in me too. So anyway, I get to this new school, man, where I'm, start fist fighting with black kids all the time. My other school I went to before this, my mom's neighborhood, like, it was a very diverse school, and we all kind of got along for the most part, because it was black, it was white, it's Irish, it was Italian, it was Cambodian, it was Puerto Rican. Now I move and it's 20 white kids, not 20%. There was just 20 of us that went to that school, and it was tough. And I would come home from school, and I could have a black eye, or I can have a trophy in my hand. And neither my parents or my step parents were going to say, "Huh, how'd you get that, son?" It's just,
Wow.
it wasn't parenting style. And anyway, I start cutting school. Tell you a real quick funny story about that is, I started cutting school every day, and it was Philadelphia, so I would take the train down in the center city, Philly. And when I would go down the center city, I would always like sneak in the museums, and there's a lot of historical stuff. You know what I mean? We have the most famous crack in all the world, cracking the Liberty Bell. So everyone comes from all over the world to see our crack. But anyway, I loved the city of Philly, and I loved the historical part of it. And I used to go sneak into Ben Franklin's house every day. Like, I used to go down there almost every day, and he was one of the main exhibits. I would always sneak in. And because all the school kids that were there for school class trips, they would be coming out of there, and they'd come out the back door, a big long line of them, because they went through there as a class trip. And I wait until the door open, I pop in, I run in there and go hang out all day and do all the exhibits and learn everything about Ben Franklin. Fast forward, before I'm going to tell you when I get into this group, but the next year, I went back to school for a very brief moment. And funny thing was, I went back to school for a very brief moment then following year. And when I was there, the school goes, "Hey, we're going to Ben Franklin's house for a class trip." And I'm telling everyone in my class, I'm like, "Oh man, I sneak in that place. I'll tell you all about it. I'll show you all the exhibits. I'll show you how this works, that works." I'm, bragging. I'm a kid, just did this for a year, a couple of months. I snuck in this guy's house. So anyhow, what happened was, we go down to for the class trip, and as we go into the class trip, pull up in the front door. Now again, I'm bragging to everybody, "Hey, I sneak in here, I sneak in here." Well, soon you pull up in the front door. I've never been through the front door. There's a big sign. We get off the school bus, there's a big sign that says free admissions. So, and I'll tell you this, and I just tell you that story just to tell you what's wrong with my brain, because when I was stealing the knowledge, I could tell you everything about Ben Franklin. As soon as I found out it was free, I was like, "That's stupid." You know what I mean? Like, just crazy. You know. So that was my life in an eggshell right there. Well, let's go back now. So what happens is, that summer I got to get out of the city. My uncle, who moved up to the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area, not Lancaster, Pennsylvania, but the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area. And if any of you guys have ever been through that area or know that area, it's all Amish people. So my aunt and uncle, they moved from South Philly. They're not Amish, they were civilians, and they moved up in that area, and they brought their kids with them. And my cousins hated it when they first moved up there. They hated living up there. I mean, they went from living right around the corner from all of their cousins, and literally we all lived right around the corner from each other, to now being up in farmlands with Amish people. So my uncle used to come get us younger cousins to come hang out with those cousins up there to try to, you know, ease it out a little bit. You know what I mean? At least bring some of the home up to them. And so my uncle used to always come get me because I didn't have my, you know, always being passed and forth between my mom and dad. I really was kind of lost. And my uncle would always say, and me and my cousins that lived up there were very, very good friends. I mean, I loved hanging out with my cousins up there. So, and it was, for me, it was a great, I loved it. They hated it. I loved it. I mean, seeing, you know, Amish people in horse and buggies and seeing cows and pigs and chickens. And I don't know if you know, like Amish people, like really turn butter for like, they don't do it because they're reenacting it. They really just turn butter. And that stuff to me was like fascinating. So I loved it up there. And anyway, I go up there for the summer, this summer. I spent the summer before up there. So that's when I became a skateboarder punk rock kid with that same cousin. We got real into punk rock, real into skateboarding. So I go up that summer, this summer now, and I walk into his room, and he's got like a swastika flag. He's got like a Confederate flag. He's got stuff about like neo-Nazis on his wall, like newspaper articles. Then my cousin comes home, and when he comes home, they, as they come home, he was shaved bald. And the year before, man, he was, you know, mohawked out and punk rocked out. Now he's like shaved bald, he has nicely cropped pants on, nice jacket on, and you know, just looks different, looks cleaner, looks neater. And we start talking about, you know, I start talking about what he's into, and he starts telling me about how he's into this new thing, these neo-Nazi groups, and how he's, you know, they're for the white race. And I'm like, all right, whatever.
And how old were you at the time?
13. I'm 13 going on 14 years old right this summer. This is like, yeah, I probably went up there right in the beginning of May, and I was turning about to turn 14. So, and why, I go up there.
Why do they shave their heads?
It's an old English thing. It's from England. It was an old working class English thing. Skinheads ain't racist. They didn't start out neo-Nazis. They started out in England in the, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, mid 60s, you know, into the 70s. And they were English working style, you know, working class kids. And that was just the kind of the thing to do. They were like all English working clothing, and Doc Martens were like the English working boots. So it was all about like the working class style. Mm-hmm. And okay. If you look at some of the old historical stuff, some of the old skinheads said, because they were always fighting, even in England, even though they weren't like, again, they weren't like a racist group to start with. They were like kind of political in a way, and they were, you know, but they weren't. There was black skinheads and white skinheads back then, and they were very into like the Jamaican music, and so it was a little different. But a lot of them like to shave their head because you couldn't pull their hair in a fight, because a lot of it's about fighting. So you can't, it takes one less weapon away from the people you're fighting with. So that was, you know, one of the rumors, and I kind of agree with it. So
interesting.
So all these other neo-Nazis used to come over my cousin's house at night. And when they would come over, you know, they were older guys. They were, you know, 16, 17 year olds. They had cars. They sometimes would bring one or two girls over with them. They always brought beer. And to me, man, they were just totally cool. They just were. And they had swastika tattoos and whatever. And, you know, I don't know. I think it's cool. But when these guys start sitting around, they start talking about multiracial society don't work. Now they're talking amongst themselves, you know, they're 16 and 17 year olds. And they start talking about like black people. I can tell like these people ain't been around black people before. You know what I mean? Like they live in the farms. They live around Amish people, not black people. So when they would start talking about like multiracial society don't work, I don't know what that means. But once they start talking about blacks and whites not getting along, I start kind of like, even my cousin would say, yo, you understand, like my cousin over here, like really lives in one of those neighborhoods you all talk about. So I would, they would always ask me like, what's it like? What's it like being around there? What's it like being around black people? What's it like? Is it really this rough? Is it really? And for me, that was someone asking me, how's my day? You know what I mean? Like someone was asking me, how's my life? Because my parents didn't ask me. My parents never asked me, how'd you get that black eye? How'd you get the stroke? They just didn't. They didn't have time for me. And that's just the truth. And now here's these guys who sit around and drink and be like, so what's it really like? And to me, that was someone going, yo, how's your day? How's your life, Frank? Are you okay? And I got to tell these guys, like, no, like it's hard where I live. It's really hard. So the crazy thing was when I would go and I would start going and hanging out with them, and they would go to nightclubs and they would go to like concerts and punk rock shows, and I would go with them, and I still had my little skater haircut, but they all were shaved bald and they were all together, and other neo-Nazis would show up and they were shaved bald, and they would all get together and they were cool. And what I noticed was when they would stand outside the nightclubs, everyone was afraid of them. You know what I mean? Everyone was scared of them.
Are they teenagers? A lot of them are teenagers, or?
Yeah, they're all teenagers. They're all 16, 17, maybe 18 at the most year old kids. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, I'm on the site. So what happened was when I noticed that people were scared of them, I loved that. Mm-hmm. You know, up until that point in my life, I can look back on it now. I didn't know it then, but I look back on it now, like, yo, I was a scared little boy. And at 14, I was still a 14-year-old kid, but I probably stopped mentally growing from when my stepdad moved in. So probably 8 or 9. And I feared everything. I feared my parents. I feared my step-parents. I feared my school. I feared if I was going to have enough food to eat some days. Now people fear me? All right. I like this. Yeah. So they asked me to shave my head and later on that night. And I remember they shaved my head. And, you know, there was something else that had happened in my neighborhood that I heard a lot. I would hear people always say things like, my uncles and cousins and different people in the neighborhood, they'd always, if you picked up a penny, what are you, a Jew? Everyone laughed, picked up a penny. Or if Johnny didn't bring you back the right change, if Johnny didn't bring you, give you the right change of the story, the first thing you could say is, well, you know, it's because Johnny always trying to Jew somebody. And everybody laughed. It was just, and look, my neighborhood had ethnic jokes for everybody, right? I mean, you joked about the blacks, you joked about the Latinos, you joked about the Italians, and those all groups did the same thing about us, right? I mean, it was just the nature of the beast of living in a you know, metro area like that. Mm-hmm. But I remember not getting why they would say these racist jokes and why that was so funny. Like, I would ask my uncle, like, why is that funny? Like, when you would say Johnny Juju today. And he goes to tell me one day when I was probably about 10 years old, this was years before this was happening. I said, why is that so funny when you say Johnny tried to Jew you? And he goes, well, see, Frank, the Jews, they're notorious for money. And you know what? You'll get the joke when you're older. It's a funny joke. You'll get it when you're older. Well, I could tell you that when I went to my first neo-Nazi rally, my first little get together, or first little group where I was going to go sit with these guys next. I shaved my head. I'm not part of this group. I'm sitting in this as a Bible studies. They taught how to hate through the Bible. And it's this Bible studies. And there's this man, a guy who's in his, you know, manhood to me. He's probably in his mid 20s. He's preaching to all of us. And he starts talking about that. He goes, you know, the Jews secretly funnel money from the Federal Reserve. And they, you know, distribute it throughout all the Jews in the world and in Israel. And what happened to me while he was saying this stuff? For one, I'm 14 years old. I don't know what the federal, I'm 48. I still don't know what the Federal Reserve does. You know what I mean? It's always bad stuff, you know? But now he's like, the Federal Reserve is controlled by the Jews. And what we called back then, Zog. That was the name of the when they talk about the deep state, you hear people talk about deep state today. Well, we actually had a name for it. It wasn't just, it was called Zog. Zionist occupational government, and it's the secret Jewish government that runs the world and runs America, runs everything. And so they would say Zog is secretly taking money out of the Federal Reserve and da 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 da. And as he's explaining it, all I remember as I sat in that meeting was, I get my uncle's joke. I get the joke. I must be older. I must be older now. I got the joke. And my uncle said, when I'm older, I will get it. I must be older. And I want to be older. I want to be adult. The adults in my life left me to fend for myself. So I want to know what they know. So I was in, man. Like, I was like, wow, I'm learning the secrets of the world. These guys are real. And that thing, and that movement became my life from that point on.
Can you explain, just one thing you mentioned was that they would teach hate through the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm assuming this means like the verses in the New Testament that are like anti-Jewish or seemingly anti-Jewish. Or
No.
It was the Torah.
The Torah. Oh, yes. You ready to hear a good story?
Yeah.
You're gonna love it. And then I'm going to tell you the story, and then I'm going to show you how factually this is what they really believe. It's going to blow your mind because it's stuff that you've probably heard before. So they say that when Adam and Eve, when Hava was going to, when the serpent man comes to Eve to partake of this fruit of knowledge and this tree, that's not what really happened. They say, come on now, you got to read between the lines. Why wouldn't they be able to take from one tree? The thing is that they never had sex before. So what happens is the serpent man comes to her and he gets to have some action with her. And he impregnates her with Cain. So what she does is once she does this one deed, now she has this knowledge of this deed. Okay. So now she goes back and she knows that she's pregnant. So she runs back to Adam. That's why she tricks him and says, hey, you have to do this with me. And it's not eating a piece of fruit. It's not partaking of a fruit. It's partaking of her. Mm. And that now she's going to lie to him and say that Cain, this first baby in her, is his. So now we got the first Maury Povich episode going on. Okay. Right. But let me just get, it even gets even more weirder. So now that Satan or the demons, and this demon snake person in the story, he, since he impregnates her with Cain, Cain later on kills Abel. Cain is banished, and Cain is the first real evil Jew on the planet. Wow. So you'll hear this now, just so you know, when next time you ever look up or research any of these groups, these Christian identity, these hardcore Christian conservative groups, And you look up where they say things like the Jews are the seed of Satan. I don't know if you've ever heard. It's a saying, the Jews are the seed of Satan. It goes back to that story. It's from that story.
Yeah. Or so, you hear like lizard or what is it called? Serpent. You hear these kind of, yeah, they say these kind of things.
Yeah.
Reptilian, you know, shapeshifter, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. So that's, I mean, and when I would hear that stuff, now I was born and raised, again, I wasn't, I didn't know I was Jewish until later, much, much later on. So what's funny is I was born and raised Irish Catholic, and I had, was just born and raised Catholic. So I went to catechism. I went and I learned, that Bible. And I never heard Father Wassel or Sister Mary Agnes, the nuns. They never taught me that story that these guys were teaching me, and so it was always, again, it was always like unlocking something. Something's new, something's deeper, something's this way. So, one second, turn on the light here. Sorry, guys, I'm gonna turn on a light.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's sure. Okay. Sorry. I might edit that out. So I'm gonna try and leave these lights on. So that was just some of the stories. I mean, all people other than the Jews who are from the Satan, everyone else is beast of the fields. If you can't get blood in the face, that's this theory, even though we know, and I know now that Jewish people blush, a lot of people blush, even white skinned black people blush. Even black people can blush, but there's even a theory and a saying called blood in the face. If they can't get blood in the face, usually meaning European, then you're not white and you're not, it means you don't have a conscience, and that only God gave the people that blush a conscience.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
Yeah. And now we need to pick up arms, because in the in their New Testament, and the, you know, at one, just one part, just one part, JC said, or Jesus says, sell your cloak and buy a sword. And to them, that means arm yourself to the gills with guns, because of that one little part in the book. Like, they take that and they run with it. Like, that's why they stockpile weapons, because one time this person in the book said, sell your cloak and buy a sword. And to them, that means ARs, MAC-10s, whatever. So just so you know what you're dealing with here.
But did, and you, that's who I'm running. Do you feel any like connection to like the Christianity, or you weren't like a spiritual person at that point? You're just being taught this stuff, and you're not really like connecting to anything, are you?
Yeah, no. I mean, there was no peace. There was no connection. There was no, you know, there was nothing working on a relationship with Hashem. There's no working a relation. No, it's, I want to bleed this stuff so I can ram it down your throat and tell you that you're wrong and that I'm right. That's it. That's all I learned it for. I learned it so I had ammunition in an argument, you know? So yeah, I mean, and a lot of the groups that run in these neo-Nazi worlds are religious like that. So now, guys, I fully get involved. I go back to the city of Philadelphia because I can't live up in the farms the whole summer. Obviously, I mean, for the summer I did. Now I had to go back down, and then I just started recruiting people. It was very, very easy in my dad's neighborhood and in my mom's neighborhood. Because my dad's neighborhood had a little alcove of white people, and in my mom's neighborhood, obviously, was Irish, and there was Italian kids up on the other end. And you know, it was very easy because it was what you do, man. It's now, I don't know that I'm pulling the greatest bait and switch of all time on people. I don't know that. I think I'm really doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and that is defending the white race. Because look at what the blacks are doing. But the truth is, the greatest bait and switch ever pulled is this. Someone says, man, I want to be proud of my heritage. How come whenever I say I'm going to be proud to be white, then everyone screams I'm a racist? But black people can say, and this is real arguments, guys. I'm using word for word arguments that people said. So they would say, but if I say I'm proud to be white, that I'm a racist. But if they say they're proud to be black, oh, that's okay. And I say, yeah, that's right. And they say, yeah, I have, they have BET, but we don't have, you know, white entertainment television, not knowing at the time that all television's white, you know, there wasn't many black people on Friends, you know, I mean, you know, so let's be real. Well, when I would hear guys like that say that, I would always say, okay, well, I want to believe that stuff too, man. Like, I believe in our heritage. So if you want to say you're proud to be white, man, come join my group, because that's what we're all about. Well, when we would go and you would come to our meetings, we never talked about being proud of our heritage. We always talked about their heritage and how come they're messing everything up and they're always treading and they're bad. Like, you never talked about our heritage in a good way. We only talked about other people. So the greatest bait and switch is these people want to have pride in this race, but when they come join our group, it's all about hate. It's all about, look at what they're doing. They're destroying everything. So it's this huge bait and switch, man. And I participated in that for years. And again, guys, just so you know, because you probably think, like, I didn't think I was evil. I didn't think I was bad. I thought I was really trying to defend the white race of America, and that, you know, the other, no one else in the world understood what we understood, you know? Like, you're really, it's a brainwashing in a way. And it's, you know, it's very, very prevalent today. It's huge today in this country. You know, it's just changed forms a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's still there. It's the same thing. So anyway, guys, as I was in the movement, I just, you know, was very violent kid, man. And I mean, 15, 16, 17, I'm I'm making a name for myself in this movement. I'm recruiting. I'm making big crews everywhere. I'm harming people. I'm like torturing Antifa, as you guys have probably all heard of the group Antifa, and, you know, the anti-fascist movement. Well, that's our biggest enemy. That's our enemy. That's our sworn enemy. And so we'd fight with them and plot and scheme against them, and they plot and scheme against us. And I used to kidnap them and hold them for ransom, and it was an ongoing war. And so, and I know with other groups, and obviously spray painting a synagogue was nothing. That was a Friday night. You know, those weren't sought out things. We just did them. It was horrible. And that's just what we did, guys. I mean, that's just the truth. I got to be honest. So people can get the truth about what these groups are like.
You were meeting at this point, like the higher ups, because you were moving up the ranks kind of. Did you meet important people in the movement?
Yeah, no, I was considered, and I don't mean this to sound egotistical because it's not about my ego today. But yeah, I mean, I started running TV shows. Now it's so fun. Hopefully you take this the right way. But what was funny is I even in the movement, I was the guy who worked in television. Again, I don't know I'm Jewish, but I'm acting pretty Jewish. Like I'm working in TV in our movement, right? Yeah. So like I have this whole thing going on, and like I'm like the promoter. I'm just the recruiter. I'm working in television. I'm the one getting the shows out there, you know. So very active in that. Very active in that. And so I'm working with some of the high ups all around the country. David Duke, who, you know, David Duke was one of the guys we worked with. Tom Metzger, you know, just you name that. We were doing things with those types of people. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, and this is what's, you know, kind of scary is, and the truth is that a lot of us in that movement were told, like, because I happened to get a big swastika on my neck early on when I was about 15. I got a big swastika tattooed on my neck. And a lot of the older guys and the David Duke-ish, and not David Duke didn't say this to me personally, but his type of people were saying to me, like, dude, don't get those type of tattoos. We need you guys to get in the military. We need you guys to become cops. Like, come home, become cops. Be, you know, that's where we're going to do the real damage to these other communities, you know, the Black community, the Latino community. This is where we'll do the most damage. So don't be getting these type of tattoos. Keep them covered up. Keep your, you know, keep your beliefs low. And of course, I was so far on the other end where I was like, no, we're foot soldiers in a race war. No way. So anyhow, guys, I wound up like kidnapping a guy in out in Springfield, Illinois, an Antifa guy, and let him go. And he eventually told the cops about the torturing and the beating and the kidnapping. And so I went to prison. I was in prison I was 17 years old. They charged me as an adult. And I wound up going to big boy prison. While I was in the same prison with John Wayne Gacy. I don't know if you guys ever studied serial killers or anything. Yeah. I mean, I was in the same prison with that guy. That's how crazy my life was. At 17 years old, they charged me as an adult. And I deserved it. I'm not one of these people that's about abolishing prisons or anything. I deserve to be there. And there's other men that deserve to be there. I don't think our prison system is run right. And I think there's too many people in there that don't need to be there. But anyway, that's a whole other topic we can get into. But the truth is, I went in there and I deserved to be in there. While I was in there, because I was one of the youngest kids in a prison, before I got sent up to prison, I had to do time in the county jail waiting my trial. You know, that's how it works. And while I was in there, I made some friends with some Black kids, just because I had to wait like 5 months to get my trial, you know, up. And I'm taking a plea bargain, but about 5 months up in the county jail, there was a couple of Black kids I was kind of cool with, played cards with, watched TV with, played basketball with, because we had a little bit.
They would see your swastika, and that wouldn't like kind of cause an issue over there, or not really?
Yeah, you're in prison. A lot of them are part of Nation Islam. A lot of them are part of Black gangs that, you know, done bad things to white people. You know what I mean? So we're just kids and they're trying to do time. You know what I mean? And if they've done any other prison time before this, you go upstate prison, man. There's tons of Aryan gangs and white racist gangs. To them, I was just one of those gang members, you know what I mean, to them. And I, you know, so, and when you're in the county jail, man, you got to keep it cool, because you're coming up on trial, you know what I mean? So you keep, you know, you might get, a lot of the times, man, you know, you always hear a lot of people say, well, where do you find God at? Well, I found him in the county jail. It's like, yeah, when you have a public defender, you need God. So, you know, everyone's being real cool in the county jail with each other. And so we, you know, they were young kids. I was young kids. We played cards together. They didn't care that I had a swastika on my neck. I mean, there's, you know, at least I was open about my racism. You know, it's the other people that aren't open about the racism they're worried about. So now, I'm up in the state prison and I get sent upstate, and some of those kids from the county jail, black kids, they wound up getting sent upstate too. And I wound up running back into them. But while I was up in the state prison, I'm running with my Aryan gangs. I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to be doing. You know, I do all my gang stuff. And, but when I play basketball and football with some of the Aryan gangs, you know, these are bikers from Southern Central Illinois. Like, they don't know how to dribble a basketball. They don't. I'm not knocking them. They can fix your transmission at 2 years old. They're bikers. You know, they're Harley riders, and they can fix your bike and your motorcycle and your car at a young age. They don't practice dribbling a basketball. They don't practice, you know, cradling a football the right way. So I did. And so when I started playing with those guys, they were horrible at sports. They just were. And basketball was a joke. I mean, they would just pick up the ball and run. They didn't dribble. And I just got tired of it, you know. So I've seen some of the black kids I came up in the county jail with, who I played basketball with in the county jail. So they knew I was good. They knew I could dish the rock off to anybody. I was a great passer. I'm a little, one of those little great little white, you know, point guards who can, you know, throw, pass the ball between your legs to another person. I mean, I was just one of those guys. And so when the black kids asked me to play, actually, one of the first sports they had me play was football. I was always very, very, very well trained and good football player as a kid growing up. So get a couple first and them kickoff returns, man, and you're the only white kid on the team, and a lot of on both teams, and the other teams, all black kids, are going to rip your head off. They're black guys. They're going to rip your head off when they catch you, and I'm doing a kickoff return. You ain't catching me. Like, I'm that fast. You know what I mean? I'm gone. I'm going to hit that hole. I'm like, if you ever watch the NFL, I'm like one of them little white football kickoff return guys, man. I just get that ball and I'm just gone. And so a lot of the black kids seen I was good. So then they made me a wide receiver. And then my nickname changed in the prison. They used to call me Aryan boy, skinhead boy, Philly boy, because I had a really hard Philly accent. I was in the Chicago prison system. And they just all started calling me Steve for this guy named Steve Largent. I don't know if you ever remember. He was a little white wide receiver for the Seattle Seahawks. And they all call me Steve all the time. And that was just like my name. It just stuck. Like, everyone called me Steve. And I was like, whatever, I'm not going to correct them. So I really didn't give a crap what you called me, you know, as long as we weren't starting trouble. So, guys, I'm in prison. I'm getting along with, again, people are like, well, didn't your Aryans care? No, I was one of the most educated racists they'd ever met. And I'm not joking. And I'll give you a quick story. In prison, there are men that dress like women. That's just the way they live their life. So be it. That's the way life is for them. I'm not judging. But in there, we call them the queens. Well, one day, this one queen was trying to talk to me for whatever reason. This black queen was trying to talk to me about something, and I blew her off. It's like, whatever. And it's a man dressed like a woman, just to give you the details of the story. And so she walked on. Well, later on that night, she seen me again, but I was standing with all the Aryans who were trying to introduce themselves to me. Again, I'm the neo-Nazi who had a TV show and kidnapped an Antifa man. I'm royalty. I'm like considered royalty in there. And the guys love taking care of me. They knew that I knew all the literature. I knew every, you know, I knew way more than any of the bikers who just got in the prison because they were, you know, and they got in there and realized they're outnumbered and they better join a gang. I'm a guy that was on the outside with a swastika on my neck. So they all liked me. So when this one queen comes walking by me in front of all these other Aryans, and she's like being rude, she's like, hey, what's up? And she's like waving to me, what's up? I was looking at her, you know, and I she embarrassed me. It was embarrassing. I mean, it was an embarrassing moment in my life. I'm standing in front of these Aryans, and she's like, hey, what's going on? And so, you know what I mean? So it was just an embarrassing moment. So one of the Aryans at the time, trying to show off to me, he goes, yo, Frank, how about that? When the master race takes over, he's getting shot twice. He's black and he's gay. And everyone's like, yeah, that's what's up. And I was like, I turned around. I was like, nah, man. I was like, no, guys, if he's black and he's gay, he's not going to be with a woman. He's not going to reproduce his race. That's what we need. And they were all like, yo, that's great. That's deep, man. Oh my God. Wow. Well, that's some deep stuff right there. Like, I was the most intelligent racist they'd ever met. So when I went and played football with black kids, they weren't like, oh, this guy's changing. And I didn't feel like I was changing. I just wanted the competition. I was a 17-year-old kid who wanted to run, who's a very well-trained and athletic kid. So I just wanted to run. And I did like showing off to the black kids, you know what I mean? I was good enough that I could talk trash, get up, take hits, all that good stuff. So anyhow, getting released from prison, guys, and I'm kind of cool with everybody. I just am. I mean, and I'm not being
three-year stint. Well, how long was it?
I did a year upstate.
It was a year.
So I get upstate, I do a year, and I'm getting out. And my anniversary, actually, 30 years ago, a week ago, I got out of jail. 30 years and 1 week ago is when I got out. So that's how long ago this story all happened, right? Well, what happens is I'm getting released from prison. And again, I'm still a neo-Nazi. This isn't American History X where like I changed or there was a change in there. Like I didn't change yet. So I get out from prison and I go back to Philly. And when I go from Illinois back to Philly, my crew back home is gigantic. I started that crew. I mean, literally the crew that is going, I started. And now it's gigantic. And so when people are coming to hang out with me, these are like new guys. And I'm like, please hope that it sounds egotistical, but I'm just trying to be for real with people. I was like a legend. I just got home from prison for kidnapping an Antifa member, our arch rival. And now I'm coming home and then I did big boy prison time. So I come home and my ego is big. I have a big ego. That's all I live off is my ego at the time, of course. And I don't know if you ever guys ever heard the saying, but you know what ego means, right? Ego stands for easing God out. So I had no God. I just had all my ego. And now I'm home. I'm trying to get this thing going. I get back with my neo-Nazi crew and I'm hearing these new guys come around and they're saying things like all black people are like this, all black people, all Latino. And I just had enough experience in prison where I was like cool enough with some people where I wasn't standing up at a meeting of neo-Nazis and going, come on guys, they're not all that way. I mean, but I felt it inside. You know what I mean? And when they would say these things, I just thought, man, that sounds so stupid. And then I started thinking about how I used to say exactly what he's saying back when I first got in. And I thought I sounded brilliant and funny. And I was like, did I sound that stupid? Wow. So I'm starting to have this little bit of change where I'm like, man, this is, I was like, you know what? I'll never forget this day. I'm taking the train up from South Philly up to Northeast Philly. And I'm on this train. And I'm on the train. I actually got talking to some black dude for about something. And I'm going to go meet up with all my neo-Nazi friends. And we're meeting this black dude and talk, very brief conversation. But I remember I had a conversation with this black dude about prisons. He gets off and he's like, all right, see you later. I said, I'll see you later. And as I'm sitting on a train, I'm about to get off pretty soon. I started thinking to myself, I was like, you know what, man, I'm not going to preach against black people anymore or Latino people anymore. Like I can admit that we're all equal. Like I got this. Like I we're kind of all screwed here in this country in a way it's set up, you know. I'm like, if you're poor, whatever, it's not, it doesn't work good for us. So I'm like, I'm not going to talk about them anymore, but I'm still going to, I have to stay part of this group. I mean, this is my everything. This is where I get clout. This is where I get all my criminal activity. This is where everything comes from for me. My ego is filled here. So I'm just going to talk against Jews. Like I know I have all the literature. I have all the everything down. I mean, just so you know, and you're sure you hear it to this day, it's the craziest thing. When you're talking with someone who's anti-Semitic and then you start proving them wrong with facts and figures and you're like, blah, 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 blah. What's their one out? Every time they have one out, that's a Jewish conspiracy. And that's it. Argument's over. That's it. We're done. And so I always had that. Well, what happened is I'm going and I'm like, I'm just going to keep on preaching against the Jews then and not just stay part of this thing. Well, Hashem has total different plans for me. I just don't know what the plan is yet. No idea. So I'm looking for work, like regular work. I'm trying to get a job. I just got out of prison. I got a big swastika tattooed on my neck, and I got skinhead written on my knuckles, and an aggravated kidnapping already on my record for life, permanent, felony. These ain't good people skills. You know what I mean? Their HR departments aren't like, oh, swastika. Management, definitely. No, come on, swastika. So, ridiculous. So what happens is, man, a buddy of mine comes to me and says, hey, I can get you a job doing antique furniture in the Cherry Hill, New Jersey mall just for the weekend. He just needs weekend workers. Would you be interested in doing that? And I was like, yeah, I don't care. You know, $100 a day for 3 days. I had no other work options. I was like, oh, let's do it. So what he did was, as soon as I said, I'll take the job, my buddy goes, you know, the dude, I said, I'll take the job. Yeah. He goes, well, I got to tell you, the dude that owns the company is a Jew. He still wants the job. And I was just like, man, I need to work, man. I don't care. I was like, I don't have to talk to this guy, do I? And he said, nope, you don't got to talk to him. And I said, did you tell him about me? He said, yep, I told him all about you. And I said, well, what did this Jewish guy say about me? And he said, he doesn't give a rat's butt what you believe. Just don't break his furniture. And I showed up and I worked for this man and I worked for him all weekend long, and very decent man, very nice man, huge Philadelphia Flyers fan. I'm a huge Philadelphia Flyers fan. So whenever we had them awkward moments around each other, you know, working, I'd say, hey, how about them draft picks? You know what I mean? Almost like, how about the weather type scenario? Like, how about them draft picks? Yeah, good draft picks. Flyers going to do good this year, a cup this, you know. And we still never won the cup, by the way. Flyers haven't won the cup since the day I was born. So I'm just saying, you know, it's a resentment I like keeping, I think, you know. Anyhow, we get done, and he has to pay me my money. And, you know, we all do this, not be anti-Semitic, but we all do this, no matter, unless you're so spiritual, you'll float right off the planet. But we all do that thing where sometimes people at work might bother you. So you drive into work and you plan the argument out in your head. You know what I mean? Where you're like, you know what? So-and-so is going to say this, and I'm going to say that to him. And I know he's a stupid Dallas Cowboys fan. And you plan out a whole big argument with somebody. You know what I mean? We do it. We all do it. Well, I did it with this man, thinking he's not going to pay me my money. He's going to Jew me. He's not going to give me the $300. He's going to say, you know, I know you made $600 in tips. So here's $100. You should give me money for letting you work here. You know, like, I'm running through all the scenarios in my head. Sorry. And sorry, guys, to edit that part. There you go. So now this Jewish man is coming up to pay me, and I'm sitting there and I'm so angry, you know, just like thinking he's not going to pay me. And he comes up to me and he says, I owe you money. And I'm like, yeah, you do. Like, how much do I owe you? You know, and I'm like, you owe me $300. He's like, oh, yeah, trade $100 a day. Here you go. And he pulls out a wad of money. Did really well at the antique show, so he had good money. So here's one, two, here's 300. He's like, you know what? Here's $100. You're extra $100, man. You're a good worker. So now I got like $1,000 from the 400 plus the 600 in tips. And all I thought about in my head was, you son of a gun. You ruined it. I had a fight waiting for you. I had an argument waiting for you. I set out landmines so you would step on these arguments to go at it, you know, because that's how I think, man. I want resentments. Again, I'm not right in the head. If you're a neo-Nazi, you're not right in the head. I mean, just so you guys know, also, throughout my whole time of my neo-Nazi, I didn't get to mention this, I'm a full-blown alcoholic. Like, I've been drinking. It's come up where I came up. It's just part of who I was. It's part of my family makeup, whatever. I'm a full-blown alcoholic, and alcoholics like resentments. Well, what happens is he gives me a ride back to South Philly from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And when he gives me a ride back, he says, hey, what do you do for a living? I told him I don't do anything. I have a swastika on my neck. I don't do anything. And he said, well, why don't you come work for me? And I went and I worked for this man for about 6 months. And he was just one of the most kindest, nicest men to be in my life. He said good things about me. I would say things like a lot of kids that are messed up like me. I would mess up or break something. My first thing is, man, I'm so stupid. I'm so stupid. And he would one day grip me up. I broke something. And I said, man, I'm so stupid, Keith. I'm so sorry. And Keith, being this little stocky Jewish dude, you know? And he's like, oy vey, what do you do to my furniture? Why do you do that? You know, just like that. Total Upper East Coast guy. And he come over, man, and he grabbed me by the back of my neck, and he said, stop saying you're stupid, you idiot. Clean it up and let's go. And so I clean up my mess the one day, and I'm driving in the truck. We're coming from upstate New Jersey, you know, down the turnpike, down the Jersey turnpike, then back in the Philly. And, man, he's just unloading on me. He's like, I hate when you say you're stupid. He's like, I you're one of the smartest guys I know. Why would you say you're stupid? And we're going back and forth, and he's like, you remember when you figured this out? And you remember when I was telling you I had this problem, and you were like, well, why don't you try this? Like, that's brilliant, good, street smart stuff, Frank. It's like, people can't pay for the knowledge you got in your head. Stop saying you're stupid. And as we're driving, he says, and here's the other thing. And this is the life lesson that man taught me that I know to this day, which keeps me moving in the way that I move, the way that I work. He said, Frank, smart people can fake being dumb, but dumb people can't fake being smart. You're just smart. Wow. Get over it. And I just looked at this man, and I'm shaved bald, neo-Nazi boots on, swastika blazing at this guy. And I'm just like, thank you for this man in my life. My God, like, thank you. I should, you know, thank you. Like, wow, this is, you know, he was just such a good man to me. And he always said good things, or he joked with the right times. He never put me down. And so he let me out. He drove me back in Philly, dropped me off. I walked back to my mom's house, man. And as I was walking back to my mom's house, I was just like, I am done. I am done. Like, I'm beating my head against the wall now to believe this stuff. And what I got tired of, and this is so much of what you see in America right now. This is so much what you see. And it's in every community. Where you hear people say, I hate all black people. And you can substitute whatever word you want. I hate all of those people, except for the ones I know from work and the ones that I'm cool with and the ones I went to school with and the ones I talked with and the ones I'm friends with on social media. They're good. They're okay. But all the rest of them, you know, just to give it a strong, you know, I hate all black people, except for Jamal and Craig. And Michael's a great guy, man. He works just like me. He's kids my age, man. We're good peoples. But all the rest of them, they're all, you know, that way. I hate all Latino people. They're all this way. Except for Juan. Juan's really cool. And John. John's a great guy. Oh, and Carlos. I mean, Carlos, me and him, we spend time together. His kids are the same age as my kids. They're a great guy. But all the rest of them are this way. Yeah. So stupid. And that's the way I thought. And here, for one more time, God's putting someone in my life to be like, who are you to judge? Are you out of your mind? Like, I'm the worst, dude. I'm kidnapping people. I'm selling stolen guns all around the country, promoting hate. Now I'm going to judge? I'm judging people now?
So I'm curious about your friend who set you up with this Jewish guy. Like, is that something that happens? Oh, I have a Jewish guy who I know who, you know, you should work for him. Like, it seems like kind of goes against what they believe. Was he as invested in the Nazi movement as you were, or was he just like a
good question?
Yeah, no, my friend was, yeah, he was. Here's the other thing. Keith had hired other neo-Nazis before. There were so many in our area that he had hired other ones before. Like, he just did. He was just like, I don't care what you believe. Just don't break my furniture. Show up on time and be able to come to work. So Mike, the guy who offered me the job for Keith, the one who offered me the job was also a neo-Nazi at one time. So he just, his name is Keith Brookstein. He's just this amazing guy who's like, whatever, you know, you do you in the world. I'm just going to keep doing me. So.
And do you think he had an effect on those other people as well, Keith?
I think so. I mean, I would hope so. I mean, I know for a fact that they all enjoyed and liked Keith. They would make fun of Keith a little bit because he was kind of a high-strung, oh my God, what are you doing? You know, so they would make fun of that sometimes, you know. But I know that he always treated them with love and respect and always paid them on time, and he never Jewed anybody. He always, you know, in fact, he would, you know, if you needed extra money, he'd give you extra money. You know, he was a good dude. So that's it.
You know, it's actually a commandment that you have to pay the wages on time.
It's
in the Torah.
I know that now.
Yeah, and it's just to see how that interplay worked is just incredible in a way.
Yeah, and Keith wasn't religious at all. Keith was not, his father was very religious, and he came from a religious background and was not religious at all. I mean, he believed in God, but he didn't have any, you know, he didn't have any, he didn't, you know, go to, he didn't do anything. I mean, he just was him. He was just him. But it's in the DNA to do the right thing, I believe. It's in the DNA, as I come to find out later on. So guys, look, I got out. Like, I just got out. People say, how? I just got out. I stopped going around them. I stopped doing what they were doing. I stopped doing all that stuff. So I get out, and then the Oklahoma City bombing happens.
I'm so sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Was getting out a hard thing to do? Like, was there any threats or, like, you know, is it that simple to just get out?
No, no, no. I lost all my friends. I lost every friend I had, every support group, everything I had was gone. And there was people that were like, yeah, we find Frank, we're going to kill him. If we find Frank, we're going to do this to him. And they did. They found me at a, see, I'm not one of these type of people that are like, hey, come get jumped out of the gang. Get out of here. I ain't. Got kidding me, you better catch me. I ain't walking to go get my butt beat from nobody. You know what I mean? But I'm gonna fight back. But they jumped me at a funeral one time. So yeah, I mean it was yeah, there was and I mean there's still threats on my life to this day, which is crazy. You know what I mean? I'm still threats on my life to this day, but whatever. I don't, you know, destroy the plans of those who seek to do me harm. Speedily defeat their aims and their purpose. You know what I mean? I don't worry about it at all. So guys, that was in 1994. I got out. That's how long ago, 1994. And I went to the Oklahoma City after the Oklahoma City bombing. Man, I went to the FBI and I said, "Hey, here's my story. Here's who I am." And I told the FBI everything. Just told them everything. And I didn't put no one in prison. No one went to jail for anything I said. I just told them everything about me. And then I went to the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, and they had me speak around some schools and some people, and I felt really good. I felt like I was getting my karma, like at a karma score, you know. And now, again, I don't know anything about my DNA breakdown. And, you know, it was just, DNA was just kind of coming around with the O.J. Simpson trial that we even know of, but learning what your DNA was or something in foreign. But anyhow, I felt like I had a really bad karma score, and I was going to try and replay that score up. And so by doing good, I was getting a good karma score. And I just did a lot of stuff. I started like speaking and helping out, and I started doing like interventions on neo-Nazis, and I started a hockey program where I got more black kids to play the game of hockey. You know, that's, you know, it's not arguably, it is the greatest game on earth. And I got to teach it to black kids, you know, this amazing game. And so I started doing that, and went on to go do it in Iowa for a long time.
Were you still drinking? Were you still?
Yeah, I'm, great question. I'm by the 1986, 1987, 1987, 80, I'm sorry, 1997, 1998, I start trying to get sober. I start, you know, having some, you know, going in and out of the program. Going in and out of rehabs, doing all those type of things. So I'm around this sobriety thing, but I'm not getting it. Like I didn't get it yet. Really struggled a lot with it. And I moved to Iowa, trying to stay sober there, get a job working in political talk radio. Then I get a job in professional hockey again, start working for all these professional hockey teams. I got maybe 3 or 4 years sober, did good, you know, build the career. Then I relapse again, burn it all down in front of everybody, start a new civil rights organization, get 2 or 3 years, relapse, burn it all down again in front of everybody. Kept doing it. And what happened was, and that's perfect lead up is 2014. You know, I've had some rough years in my life. Being abused as a stepkid, being maximum security prisons. But I'll tell you, 2014 started the worst 5 years of my whole life. My oldest son dies in a car accident. Just a simple single car, you know, no drugs, no alcohol. Just
sorry.
Lost control of his car. Then my mom dies of a fentanyl overdose in 2016. The best man at my wedding, because I've been married now. I got married and my wife was married and had kids and living in Iowa. Well, my best man at my wedding, who was my cousin, who was like my brother, he kills himself. I mean, like, we were tight. And then his older brother, who was also like my older brother, he kills himself. Then I had a colleague of one of the civil rights organization I work at stole a bunch of my intellectual properties and went and sold that he did the work I did. I did the work for 15 years. This guy just started doing the work and then went to a production company and a TV network and said, oh, I've been the guy doing all these interventions on neo-Nazis, which, and he sold it and it looked like he really was the one. It was just, and there was other, then I got a divorce and then I broken no contact orders. You know, again, now I'm back to drinking and using again because I'm in this really dark, dark place. And by this time, I find out I'm Jewish. I found out I was Jewish from a Chabad rabbi. Well, he was the first one to really bring it to my attention in Des Moines, Iowa, in 2014, right around the time that all this stuff's going on. Before it started, I was doing a documentary with him about religion in Iowa. And he was like, hey, you know, you're Jewish. You should go check it out. And because of my last name, which actually my last name is Mink, this is my mom's maiden name, but it actually isn't Jewish. But it makes me look deeper. And I put something out on social media to some of my family members. And my uncle, who years ago, when I first was becoming a neo-Nazi, he's one of these really uncles that kind of just, I never really got along with him. Kind of was an uncle that always just busted everyone's chops. You know, he just always, from what I always remember as a kid, he was always thought he was better than everyone else or whatever. Just giving you the example of why I didn't believe when he came to me when I first became a neo-Nazi. He goes, you know, we have Jewish in us. And I just really thought he was just lying to me just so I wouldn't be a neo-Nazi. Like, he would just say anything that, you know, just to bust my chops. So I was like, whatever. So I knew he couldn't say I was black. You know what I mean? So he just said, oh, we know we're Jewish. And I was like, whatever, whatever, whatever. So I put out on social media after this rabbi comes to me and says, yeah, you know, you're Jewish. My uncle, that same uncle, and a couple other aunts all chime in on social media. And they're like, yeah, Frank, like, you know, grandmom's mom's mom's mom was 100% Jewish. And she married this Irishman in, like, you know, 1890 or something like that. And so they all started chiming in, like, yeah, we're all part Jewish. So, okay, I'm gonna look into this. And to tell you a crazy story was also in that time, in about 2013, right when I was making I was making a TV show in 2011 about doing interventions on neo-Nazis that was going to be aired on AMC, the network. And I was living in LA for a brief moment for 3 months making this television show. And I was in recovery. And I was struggling in recovery, but I was going to recovery. I was going to gatherings that we're supposed to go to. And while I was at a gathering of recovering people, this man came up to me and, little Jewish guy came up to me at this meeting spot and he came up to me and said, huh, a fellow Hebe at a meeting. And I looked at him because I knew this one guy that I was talking to and it doesn't matter. This guy comes over to me and says, huh, a fellow Hebe at a meeting. And I was like, I'm not Jewish. I'm actually a former neo-Nazi. I'm making a television show. I'm all arrogant. I'm like, I'm making a television show right now on doing interventions on neo-Nazis. I'm not Jewish. And he's like, well, you look like a Hebe to me. And he just walked away. And that man I'd stayed in touch with throughout the years, just off and on. Just, he lived in LA, and when I moved back to Iowa after my TV show got canceled, I just randomly would call this man once a year. Hey, what's up? You know, what's up, man? What's going on? You know, whatever. So guys, I'm telling you that the worst 5 years of my life is going on. Me and my wife were getting a divorce. Just my life and everything is burning. I was a hockey coach who had won 12 national championships. I lost my hockey coaching career due to my divorce, due to my using, due to all my own actions. So guys, I was in that time, I found out I was Jewish, like I said. So now I'm trying to figure this thing out. And in the midst of that, I met this one Jewish girl in all of Des Moines, Iowa. There's not many, but I met the one. And me and her started dating during my divorce. And while I was dating her, I was leaving her house and I was in the middle of a relapse at the time. And I left her house to go back to the house I was living at. I couldn't go back to my house where my wife and children were because we were in the middle of a divorce and my life was spiraling out of control. So as I was driving, this lump came in my throat. Like, I couldn't breathe. You know, I wanted to scream and I wanted to cry and I just was so lost. So, and I just, and I'm driving and I just was like, and I just wanted to cry so bad. And my eyes were welling up and I couldn't see the road because I was just about to cry again. So I just wanted to cry this thing out of me. And I pulled over to the side of the road because there was no way of me driving anymore. And I just sat on the side of the road and I started screaming up at God. I was like, please kill me. Please put me out of my misery. I can't take this anymore. Like, I can't take any of this pain. I'm just lost and I'm screaming, please kill me. Cause I don't want to kill myself because my cousins all just killed themselves. And I seen the devastation that it does to people. I know that when you kill someone, when you kill yourself, you don't take that pain with you. You just pass it back down to your children, you know? And I'm like, I don't want to do that. And I was like, please God, let a Mack truck hit me. These are my exact words. Please God, let a Mack truck hit me or let a telephone pole fall on me. Please just take me out of my misery. I get it why my cousins killed themselves. If this is the pain they felt, I get it. And as I'm screaming up at him, please kill me, my phone rings and it's that girl that I've been dating. And I pick up the phone in the midst of me screaming and crying up to God. And I was like, what do you want? And she's screaming, crying on her phone. She's like, get back to my house right now. Get back to my house. And I was like, what? Why? And she said, I just found out my sister just killed herself. I need you here with me right now.
Oh my God.
And And I just hung up the phone and this is my story. This is my story. This is just like, it's my God. You know, when I hung up the phone, this little voice just came to me inside the car and said, get to California. I have work for you. And I just remember, I can picture this. I think about this moment 20 times a day, sometimes 100 times a day. I think about this moment because it happened. And I just looked at my dashboard where the voice didn't come from the voice just came to me. And it was not my own voice. That was the one thing. It was the most weirdest thing. It wasn't my own voice. It was something else that said it to me. And I just said, okay, I'll listen. And what that voice said, get to California, man, call that man who called me a Heeb, because me and him had stayed in touch throughout the years. And he's this magical, I don't want to talk him up too much, but he's a magical man who knows how to wrestle people's egos out of them with love and walk them closer to God. And he's very good at doing it. And he does it. He was born and raised Orthodox. I don't want to tell too much of his story. He was born and raised Orthodox, but now he teaches men how to find God through the program of recovery. And he works with a lot of big people, whatever. Like I said, I had talked to him throughout the years where he used to say, Frank, I can help you. He's like, you're insane, but you have some gifts and I can help you. But, you know, you have to be willing to really want to be helped. And what you need for that program to work in your life is you need G-O-D, gift of desperation, that I knew I couldn't live another day with the way I was living and the way I think. And so I called that man and said, hey, after I heard that voice, after I got done helping that girl with her sister's death, I was of service to her. And then we kind of just broke up and went our separate ways in a kind, gentler way. I said, hey, I got to go to California. I got to go work with this man because I can't do this thing. And I've been with that man now. And now when I stay with him, I just mean he's my spiritual guide. He's my rabbi in recovery. He's not a per se rabbi. He's, you know, was born and raised Orthodox, but he teaches men how to get this thing through recovery. And I still work with that. I talk to him every morning to this day. It's been 4.5 years. And in that time, the government and other people have come to me. And now my life is in shambles. And now the government and everyone's coming to me going, hey, we heard you know about a lot of neo-Nazi cops. And I said, yeah. And they said, well, you come testify in front of the United States Congress for us. And when you testify to the names, and you know, will you tell the truth? And I said, absolutely. And so that happened about 3 years ago, three and a half, no, almost 4 years ago. And I went and I testified, and my life has changed dramatically from that moment. And anyway, I very active now. When I came here, I got not just in recovery, I got very active in Judaism, in my Judaism, and became part of a temple, go to Torah studies 3 times a week. You know, keep a Shabbat in my life. Stay kosher. Do the 100 blessings a day, which is one of my favorite things to do, is the 100 blessings a day. You know, pray 3 times a day. And my activism and what I believe my God wants me to do is to, he's not, my servitude tells me that he's not very happy with mass incarceration. He's not very happy with the imprisonment of the poor that we do. And a lot of it goes back to policing and traffic stops and pulling people out of cars for every little thing. And God's like, I'm going to give you some of the answers, and you're going to go out and you're going to talk about it. And that's what I've been doing for the last 4 years. Cause you know, when I read Proverbs, and that's one of the great things I love about being Jewish now, is that I don't go around and try to browbeat people with the Proverbs. I just try to live them to the best of my ability. And I try to educate myself on the situations God wants me to go out and be of service to him for, and just do my best. And so that's where I am today, doing that work.
So I'm curious to know about that, that voice that you heard in your head or whatever it was. Is that voice something that like you kind of use as an inspiration? Like when you pray, do you feel like you're kind of trying to get that voice back? Is that something that, you know, obviously really impacted you, but did that change your whole outlook on prayer? Because you were praying, you were shouting and crying out to God, and then something happened miraculously almost. And now as a Jew, as a practicing Jew, do you feel like when you pray, like there's actually something on the other side that's listening?
I when people talk about God, if Hashem is real, any of that, I always go 1,000,000%. I know he's real. And because of that moment, and because not even just because of that exact moment, but because of me listening to the voice of going to the man that was envisioned in my head, to go to that man, he's going to help you. And the way that he has taught me to find and to practice and to believe. And not only that, is to rely on him. And so, so because of that moment, it lets me know that it's real. Yes. So you're right. It's the, something is on the other side. I love prayer and meditation now. I mean, I look for, so every morning, just, you know, you do you, I do me. That's one thing it says, love the Lord, your God, my God, I get to do what I want. Every morning since I live out here on the West Coast now, I take an hour and a half walk every morning, and I call it my God walk is what I call it. But in that walk, what I do is I get to keep saying the word stay, like, because you know, when you're on an hour and a half long God walk or a walk period, your mind starts to go, oh, why didn't so and so text me back yesterday, go, bah, 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 da, 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 all about myself. Well, the voice that I have inside of me gets to go stay, STAY, stop thinking about yourself and just think about others. Think about all the people that I help in the program, you know, I'm very, very active in my recovery. Like, I help a bunch of other men find their way through recovery. And so that doesn't have to be, you know, so they're not Jewish, or just in some are, some, you know, one is now, but all my other guys, they're not, but I walk them just as I would walk anyone else to a relationship with God by using the tenants that are in this recovering lifestyle. Again, you have to be anonymous about this stuff. So I can't just go like, hey, I'm part of this one group. You know, that's very, very important that we don't do that. So that's why I have to tread on this tradition very lightly. But most people that know about the program will know this guy's in recovery. So the reason why I say that is, you know, that's a huge part of my service, is to help other men get out of that life of hell. And it is a life of hell by working the program. So
that's a minute. Question. Do you go by also a Hebrew name now?
Not yet. I want to. I'm one of the things that I've come to every Shabbat, I usually do a lot with King David. I love King David. Like, that's my guy. I just love
my favorite. I think he's everyone's favorite character.
Really is.
Yeah. He is. Because he's the perfect example of a human being who if you do the right, to me, what it says to me, and again, I don't ever preach. I don't preach. I love, that's one of the greatest things too about us. We don't get, I don't got to preach for my, I know I have a personal relationship and where I get my strength from. But when I look at where, you know, when we do stuff for ourselves, it's not so, I don't say God's against it. It's just not blessed as much as when you're doing it for the people. You're doing it for your tribe, or you're doing it for, to make others, you know, be able to be healthy and better. That's when it works better. And it, I see that a lot in King David's life, you know? And so I try to stick to that. And, you know, and there's one question I ask every rabbi I come across all the time. I always go, why do you think, no matter what, why did he grab five stones when he went to Goliath? Shoot. Sorry, guys. One of my biggest questions I always ask people is, why did he grab five stones when he should have just grabbed one? He only needed one, you know? And you just love those type of deep thought thinking. For me, it's a very deep thinking thing. Is, but the last thing I will say, guys, or not the last thing, but what's very important to me here is, oh, my God. Sorry. Somebody keeps calling in.
That's okay.
Sorry about that.
We don't hear anything. You can keep going.
Don't worry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that in America, the truth is that in 50 years, we're going to be one tribe is molding here. It's in 50 years, like that mixed race American is going to be something that is going to be so prevalent. And then 300 years, almost all of us are going to be the same color. Like, that's just the truth. And then we're going to be that tribe for thousands of years. Thousands of years from now, we're going to be all one color here. So when we look back on things like mass incarceration, when we look back on things where a certain community keeps saying, yo, we're being abused by this one certain situation, and they're telling us we're being abused, you know, we're going to look back and go, oh, we should have listened. You know, and I know that right now it's really hard for us to say those people or these people are right, because some right now, some people are really turning their backs on us. And I get it, man. I get it. But the truth is, if you go back to Martin Luther King, you go back to Malcolm X, you go back to James Baldwin, you go back to all these great American Black leaders, they've all talked about police brutality, all of them. And we have mass incarceration on a scale that never has been seen before. And it's mostly off of them. So what are we going to do when this tribe starts to more and more come together? We're going to look back on these times, just like when we look back on cops sigging dogs and shooting fire hoses and killing them. And we all look back now and go, oh, why didn't we see it? What was wrong with us? We're going to do the same thing 20 years from now, 30 years from now. We're going to go, oh, yeah, they used to this pull people over for any reason just so they could rip them out of their car and search their cars. That's insane. And we have mass incarceration because we didn't stick to the Bill of Rights. One of the great things about this country isn't the people. Like, we got to be real. People don't come here because Americans are great people. They come, they don't. It's the truth. We have some serious problems and issues. They come here because we have amazing Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights isn't really given to everybody. It's just not. The Fourth Amendment isn't respected on Black people or people of color or poor whites. It's not. Cops don't care. They'll rip them out of their cars in front of their children, search them. And it's something that should not be happening in this country.
How prevalent is this? You mentioned that you spoke to the FBI, like, and you spoke in Washington. How prevalent is this problem where they're like, they're infiltrating, you know, our different bodies of government and so on, and policing? Like, how bad do you think it is?
It's not that there's like hard carrying neo-Nazis anymore. It's not that. It is that they're, a lot of their unions and their membership is very, and I'm for conservatism. I'm for people that are conservatives. I'm talking about far right extremists are a lot in our policing, a lot. It's part of the police bubble. Just go look at their unions. Go look at a lot of what their unions do and say. It really is as bad as people have been saying it is. So it's not just these white supremacists, it's Proud Boys. There's tons of Proud Boys that are police. There's tons of Oath Keepers. These are all far right wing extremist groups, and they're become cops. And there's hundreds of them in like districts and all different places. And so, you know, and we're not asking, and I the people that I work with, the activists that I work with, we're not screaming defund. I'm not for defunding the police at all. Like, fund homicide divisions, fund them rape divisions, fund those special units, fund them. But stop funding these little tricks of you know, traffic stops and pulling people out of cars for every little thing. And it's not what, if, imagine if Ben Franklin, one of my heroes, one of my biggest heroes in this, if you imagine if he would have came back right now and says, hey, how's this country? How's that freedom and liberty we left you? Oh, well, you know, we have 34% of the world's women's prison population. I will say this again. We have 34% of the world's women's prison population in a country that only has 5% of the population of the world. Oh, our freedom and liberty isn't what we thought it was. Like, our founding fathers, we horrified that we have mass incarceration on the scale we have. And just for people that are listening to this, think, oh, this is some woke liberalism. This, we're not talking about upstate prisons anymore. We're talking about the growth of the American county jails. And that's where they hold, again, and I'm not a prison abolitionist. There's people that do belong in there. But I'm telling you, that we're going down the wrong track when they get to do civil forfeitures to people. Like, there's a lot. There's a bunch of real concrete police reforms that we can do to stop what's happening to this country. So, and that's my job. That's my job today. That's the work that God said, hey, I'm going to give the work. I'm going to give you the knowledge. I'm going to give you the information, and you're going to go relay it to people. And that's what I do.
Well, God bless you for everything you do. I personally always, like, years ago when you hear things about neo-Nazis in America, you know, we don't really experience it, because also, you know, it's like right-wing extremism is not something that is culturally accepted. For example, an Antifa member, he's going to get a pat on the back, you know, by the culture, because it's, you know, it's, there's a lot of liberals in this country, and we promote certain ideas. But with right-wing extremism, you don't really, they're kind of underground. So there's always this feeling like, okay, but it's exaggerated, it's not really there. And now, ever since, especially now since after October 7th, you're starting to see like the country club anti-Semites with their bow ties coming on the news. You're like, oh, I thought they were on our side. And it's actually like the liberals, a lot of them, who are behind us. And it's not, I'm not saying, you know, I don't have the statistics, but it feels like we've been duped, you know, like, so for me, now that you're talking about all this right-wing anti-Semitism, you know, do you feel like we're heading in the right direction with that, or you feel like we're just spiraling?
No, and I don't like being alarmist, but, you know, obviously far right-wing extremism in any shape or form, no matter where it comes from, I'm not for it. But what I've watched, because now for the last 30 years, I've been very active in anti-extremist work. I mean, I've been all over the world. I've worked with different organizations. I worked with former jihadists. I worked with former Mujahideen. I worked with tons of these people for the last 30 years. That's what I mean. For some reason, Hashem has kept me relevant in that world, that when I finally had the spiritual change and I've had the spiritual awakening to truly doing this for other people, I'll tell you this, when I've watched now, so many Americans, and it's on both sides, that are blinded to the fact that they are standing behind an Iran-backed jihadist movement who, like, we're losing the marketing game here. And it's crazy that, again, we're standing behind a group that is backed by Iran, who literally call for the extermination, you know, and the genocide of us from the river to the sea. and then they call around and say that we're doing genocide. Like, we're, how we're losing that marketing war is crazy.
To me,
but we are. you know.
It debunks this whole idea that Jews run the media and all that, because if we did, we're terrible at it, right? Because
We're terrible at run, and let's be honest, before October 7th, even that, we were not good at even running Israel. We were always arguing, you know what I mean? Like, we were always arguing and protesting, and you know, like, and it just is what it is. I'm not judging anybody here. Like, we can't even run Israel right, let alone run the world. And I'll tell you that one of the other thing is, when I was part of the neo-Nazi world, and I still hear to this day from some of the groups where they always go, oh yeah, it's 10 old Jewish men get together and they in a cabal and they can rule the world. I'm like, now that I know the truth, because I go to temple and I've been very active in my community, you get 10 old Jewish men together, that's 30 different opinions on everything we're about to talk about. What do you, you know what I mean? Like, we can't even choose where we're going to go to lunch, let alone where we're going to, you know, go run the world. Are you out of your mind? Like, that's just real. That's just facts. And they're just beautiful children of God, you know? So,
What do you think, from your unique perspective, as somebody who wasn't, practicing Judaism and was anti-Jewish, what, from your point of view, where do you see like the root of anti-Semitism in this country? Where does it come from? Is it jealousy? Is it ignorance, combination?
it's good. It's both. Oh, okay. I'm about to, my phone's about to go here, but so sorry. It's a little bit of both. We are, and I'm so proud to say we, just so you know, I'm so proud to say we are a successful minority who has throughout time been the activist for others. And we can go down the whole list of the whole civil rights movement in 1963, 64 was because two Jewish men and a black man were killed in Mississippi. And that's what catapulted the civil rights bill into effect. Today, or this weekend, is St. Patrick's Day, where they eat corned beef and cabbage, which they didn't really eat that. They ate bacon and cabbage when they could. The Irish, I'm talking about, until they got close to us in America and the Jewish butchers and bakery shops. And then we started to supply them with a very, very cheap meal to keep them alive as the Irish were starving to death. And that's corned beef. And now it's an Irish tradition because we fed it to them. We fed that to them. And I think that's how my ancestors even met, which is a great story in itself. You know, everywhere we go, we stand up for the others when other people hated them. Like, people hated the Irish, we stood up with them. People hated the blacks, we stood up with them. So we've always been the success, and we've always been successful because of the way we're basically trained to be. And what I mean by trained to be is, I've come to realize the truth is that it's not that we're just the conspiracy that we're the high ups in a lot of companies and in science and in technology and you name it. You name it, we're high ups in those organizations. It's not a conspiracy. It's just that we have a heritage of learning, that we live Proverbs. You know what I mean? For 3,000 years now, we've been studying and learning because we're always on the move, and we had to study and learn when other cultures were stuck and stagnated. It's just the truth. And so now we're really good at that. And so wherever we go, we make better. Until the people turn their backs on us. And so, you
Hey,
know, it's funny.
I have a Hebrew name for you that you want to maybe consider.
Go ahead.
Natan. It means to give. Natan. Think about that one.
I'll think about it.
And
I'll
actually,
think.
connection, he's the prophet who tells King David that, the whole story about how he sinned, and he admits his wrong ways,
Oh,
right?
I didn't
Yeah.
even. So actually, I think that's a very good name for him,
Think
Natan.
about
Give.
that. Yeah,
Well,
that's the farmer who stole, the one who stole the
yes.
one. I love that story. I love that story.
Amazing story. Well, Frank, I know you said your phone's gonna die, but this was really like an
Truly an
honor,
inspiration.
and we hope to stay in touch. And we really are
Yep.
just so mind we're just blown away by your life story and where you are today. And we really wish you all the best. And you're an inspiration. You really are.
Yeah.
We feel like you're an angel. So
Oh, thank you.
for us, to be just having the honor to speak to you and to spread your message, it's just like it's an amazing opportunity for us. So thank you so
Well,
much.
thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Thank you. It's an honor for us. Shavua Tov.
Bye, guys.
Yeah.
Hey guys, thanks so much for tuning into the Judaism Demystified podcast. We really appreciate all your support and your feedback. If you want to help us grow the podcast, keep spreading the word, share it with your friends, family, or whoever you think would be interested. We also opened a Patreon, so you can become a patron, contribute any small amount you'd like, which would really help us grow the show. Our Patreon is www.patreon.com/Judaism. Pretty easy to remember. Thank you again, and we hope to keep putting out great shows for you guys. Before we go, we want to thank our Patreon supporters by name. Those are the supporters that are helping make this show happen because, frankly, Bensi and I are full-time workers who don't really have so much time on our hands because we have families, we have kids, and it's just a passion project that got way bigger than we expected. So we're dedicating more time to this, and obviously our production value up until this point hasn't been great, considering that we filmed this in Bensi's basement using a green screen and a crappy little microphone and not such great equipment, to be honest. I'm sure you all realize that. So we are hoping to up our quality and get better equipment. And part of that process is going to be due to you guys, the listeners and supporters. If you go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/Judaism, you will see all the different tiers of ways you can help us out. So first of all, we want to thank our super patron, Jordan Carmilli, our platinum patron, Craig Gordon, our gold patrons, David Chaya Abramchayev, Laser Cohen, Travis Kruger, Vasily Volkov, silver patrons, Ellen Fleischer, Daniel Maksumov, Rabbi Penny Rosenthal, and Jeffrey Wasserman. Thank you all for supporting the show, and we hope you guys enjoy.